Tonight I want to really start off our discussion by talking about three men. And I'm deliberately leaving out Isaac and Jacob because I want to address the points that Abraham and Joseph and Moses, and look at the things that they went through, and the way that God used them to further His cause. I have the names on the board, and I've just titled it Three Men. But I want to look at each one of these and see if we can't really get some lessons from them. When we look at Abraham and the call that God gave to him to leave his country and go into a land that he would show him, and the end result was he's going to give Abraham the land that he displays to him. Abraham left, and as we follow him in his journey, we find that Abraham's faith in God grows just about every day. We see something happen that Abraham has to really get down deep to go with. But at each step, he shows that his faith is growing. And you know, that's a characteristic that we ought to ourselves try to emulate in our lives. We need to make our faith grow all time. That's what Abraham did. And we see Abraham as he made some mistakes. He made one with the Pharaoh when he identified Sarah as his sister. She was, but it was just a half-truth. And then again, with Abimelech, he went through the same drill again. But at the end, When God told him to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, Abraham took off from Mount Moriah. And he must have been reasoning with himself that he doesn't understand how God is going to fulfill His promises through the man if he has been killed as a sacrifice. But he says he can bring him back to life if he has to. And so Abraham goes through all of the motions and is ready to slay the young man when God stops him. And God made a statement there that I believe lets us see what God was doing. God was testing Abraham with every step. And when God saw that Abraham was not going to hold Isaac away from him, but he was going to go through with whatever God said do, God said, "Now I know." And he dealt with some things there that I think said that God has tested Abraham to the limit, that this far as he feels he needs to test him. He knows Abraham's going to do what he wants done. Now, the next man that I want to look at, I want to look at Joseph. And Joseph starts out as a young man about, I think we guess about 17 years old. But he's in the prime of life, and his brothers have gone through all of the motions to get him ready to be slain, and a caravan shows up. It's a bunch of Ishmaelites, called in another passage Midianites. But they're brothers, both of them sons of Abraham. But instead of killing the lad, they take an animal and use its blood to stain Joseph's coat that they're going to carry back to Jacob. But they sell the young man to these Ishmaelites. Well, Joseph is carried down to Egypt and sold into slavery to a man who has a wife that is a very, she's a little forward with things, I would say. But Joseph's faith was tested with just about every step he took. And after that accusation by Potiphar's wife, Joseph was thrown in prison. Well, he rose pretty high in prison, and he came in contact with two of the Pharaoh's official servants, and he explained a dream to them. They had a dream, and they wanted to know what is the meaning of this dream that we're dreaming. He told them that one of them was going to be beheaded, and the other one was going to be restored to his position. And for about 2 years, best we can tell, that was the last that Joseph heard of him. He asked him to remember him before Pharaoh, but about 2 years, something came up, and Pharaoh was needing someone to explain a dream for him. Nobody could do it. The official that had been restored to his position remembered Joseph at this time. So he told Pharaoh what Joseph had done for them, and Joseph was sent for. Well, Joseph performed so well before Pharaoh that he turned out and made him second in command for all of Egypt. And it was his job to collect taxes in terms of foodstuff or animals or money at a point in time, so that during 7 years of plenty, they could prepare themselves for 7 years of nothing. And that was done, and Joseph handled it rather well. But in the process, his family came down to buy grain from no less than their son, their brother. Well, Joseph took advantage of the situation and kind of quizzed the brothers on a few things and found out how things were going at home and what their father thought about and if he was well. Still not letting them know what's going on. The bottom line is, as Joseph went through the interaction with his brothers, he found out all he needed to know what they had done. And when he revealed himself to them, I would say to be scared to death would be an understatement about how they felt. Because here is a brother that they had sold into slavery, lied to his father about him, and now he's in a position where he could have any one of them or all of them executed with no explanation. He was in a high position. And they realized it, but they could never get it across to themselves that, hey, he doesn't hold any ill will toward us. They never did believe that. And when Jacob died, they figured Joseph would take advantage of the situation and they were in for trouble. But he didn't. And he went through the rest of his life with that kind of an interaction with his own brothers. They didn't know what was going to happen next. But what it turned out, Joseph, when he died, another Pharaoh came in power, and the children of Israel were changed from maybe caretakers for the Pharaoh's cattle and herds to being slaves to do every dirty thing that needed to be done in the kingdom. They went from being in pretty good shape to being in a terrible shape as far as their workload was concerned. Okay. Long about this time, after Joseph has died and several years have passed, the children of Israel have grown immensely in numbers. They have become such a threat that the people in Egypt feel like they've got to stop them somewhere. So they put out an order that with the midwives that when a Hebrew woman gives birth, if it's a little boy, throw him in the river. If it's a little girl, let her live. China did something similar this few years ago, but it was the little girls that they didn't want. But anyway, Moses' mother hid him in a little ark in the reeds there on the Nile River. So for the next 40 years, her baby son is trained in the court of Pharaoh in all of the things that a child of Pharaoh would be schooled in. He was brought up as a high-level Egyptian official. Now, we don't know all that means, but he was living a life of privilege and getting the best education that the people in Egypt were capable of giving someone. Well, somewhere along the line, Moses came up with the idea that he was to be the one that would rescue his people from their situation in Egypt. He was going to be their deliverer. How he came up with that, I can't imagine unless it was from his mother. But anyway, he felt that, and when he had an encounter with a Egyptian who was abusing one of his brethren, he killed the Egyptian, hid him in the sand, and like everything was just all right. Next day or so, he sees the people again, and this time they ask him, who made you to be rule over us? You gonna do to me the same thing you did to the Egyptian the other day? He knows then that he's exposed. So he leaves, and he goes to the land of Midian. And there he encounters a priest of that land, and he works in with them, and he spends the next 40 years in Midian, working in the house of the priest of Midian, and married one of the priest's daughters. So Moses sitting pretty well. And then one day he was walking through the mountains and he noticed a bush over here in the corner of his eye that's on fire. Except it's not burning up. And he can't understand. So he walks over a little closer and a voice comes out of the bush and says, take off your shoes for what you, where you're standing is holy ground. His first indication that he's in the presence of God himself. And God tells him, I want you to go down to Egypt and bring my people out. How would you feel if somebody gave you that job? He don't know how to do it. He knows the last time he was down there, they were trying for his head. So here he stands before God, and that's the last job in the world that he really wanted, was to go back down to Egypt and encounter the Pharaoh and tell him to turn his people loose. But finally, he got through his excuses, and every excuse that he made, God countered and said he's going to give him Aaron to be his spokesperson, and that would take care of his slowness of speech. Although if I look at 40 years of education in in Egypt, in Pharaoh's court, and then pile on top of that 40 years dealing with the shepherds there in Midian, I'd say the man's pretty well prepared for whatever he wanted to do. He didn't feel that way. And I don't know whether that's an excuse he was making or whether he was really in between a rock and a hard place right now. God's telling him to do it. He doesn't feel he can. So God convinces him, I'll take care of the speech part of the business. You just talk to Pharaoh. I'll tell you what to say. So Moses headed out toward Egypt, meets Aaron. They come together, and then he is introduced to the people there. Moses is not even sure the Israelites will accept him at this point in time. But everything works out, and they go to meet with Pharaoh. Well, God gave Moses a couple of signs that he could use to kind of get Pharaoh's attention. One of them was he'd throw his rod down in front of Pharaoh and it would turn into a serpent. And it was so realistic when he threw it down, it scared him. And God said, don't be afraid, pick him up by the tail and go back into a rod. So he gets to Pharaoh's presence and shows this. What you got going back there? Anyway, y'all put up with me. I'll go on, let them play with their things back there. Anyway, he went through the drill, and the sorcerers there in Egypt, they could duplicate that trick, and they did. And then the next thing he was to show them is put his hand in his bosom and pull it out, and it is just white as snow with leprosy. Well, leprosy was a fatal disease among all of the people back in those days. It was something that you could not get away from, something that the priest had to get involved with to make you clean again. All Moses had to do was put his hand back in his shirt and pull it out again. It was clean. Well, the sorcerers did that, and they did several other tricks, turned water to blood and flies and lice. When they got the lice, they'd bombed out. They couldn't duplicate that. And they told Pharaoh that, hey, there's something here that we don't understand. But Pharaoh doesn't relent. He's not going to let the Israelites go. And God has a whole list of things, 10 of them to be exact. The last one being the firstborn child of every family is going to die. So Pharaoh, he doesn't know what's going to happen here. He's been through 10 plagues now. And finally, he's got one that's going to touch his house. So the Israelites go through the procedure that is prescribed for them. And then they come out. And Pharaoh's son is dead. So Pharaoh decides that it's time to get those people out of our country quickly. So God has used Moses in one of the most delicate situations that he could have been put in his life. Not anything he would have expected, but he's done pretty well. And to make a long story short, Moses went through the rest of his life, the next 40 years. He's 80 when he starts with the children of Israel. He's going to be 120 when he reaches the end of his life. And he's going through that last 40 years doing everything that God wants him to do, except one thing. He made a mistake one time, and instead of giving the credit to God for a miracle that was performed, he claimed it for him. And God told him, just for that, you will never go inside the land of Canaan. And Moses begged a little bit, and the Lord told him, I don't want to hear any more about it. And that was the end of it. So, now here, we've talked about Abraham. We've talked about Joseph. We've talked about Moses. And the reason I wanted to go into these as much as I have tonight, these are people that are at the very beginning of God putting his plan for even us into action when it was first begun. And I think we ought to think about at least those three, because they all went through some very ticklish situations in their obedience to God, and they passed. They did what God wanted, and they learned to live with God and to give him the respect and service that he wanted from them, and he wants from us. And we need to remember that one. Now, at this point in time, really we've talked about the children of Israel as all the things, provisions have been made back over time, and we have people in place that are actually going into and implementing the things that are going to take place to get God's people outside of Egypt and on their way to the promised land, which God has promised to them. I don't plan to go into a step-by-step repeat of all of the things that happened between the time when they left Egypt and when they went into the land of Canaan itself. One of the first things what we need to note is those people started their grumbling and griping and complaining almost the minute they stepped away from the treasure city where the parade started. They didn't like the food. They didn't have enough water. They're out in this desert. They're uncomfortable. And God, Moses had a job of nursemaiding some of the best complainers I've ever even read about. They could complain about things that were going just right. But they complained. And Moses at one time asked God, "What have I done to deserve this?" It got to be just about all Moses himself could handle. But Moses hung in there. He hung in there. I'll get it right in a minute. And so they go through, they exit Egypt, and I'm not going to try to tell you where they went from there. There, I know of at least three different routes that they are said to have been able to take, but I couldn't tell you which one they did take and which one they didn't take, or whether any of them. They may be something that I'm still not aware of. But they sent the spies into the land, and the spies came back, as we recall, came back, and two of them, 12 spies, one from each tribe, and they went all over the land, and they came back with various reports. Caleb and Joshua said, "Hey, we can take them." No doubt about it. They were ready to go. And the 10 said, "No, we can't. Those people are so big in there. We look like grasshoppers in front of them." So they didn't want to go. So God made up his mind right then, you guys are not going in there. And when they realized that, hey, they have missed their transit point, they have made a mistake, and maybe they better turn around and go in anyway. Moses tried to talk them out of it. They didn't listen. And the bottom line was, they got whipped bad there with just a little old village that they tried to take. God just turned them over to them. And so we watch as God lets an entire population die, all but two men. And those two men were held over and formed the leadership of the next generation when it was ready 40 years later to go into the land of Canaan. And from there on, we begin to follow them and see the things that they got into. And God gave them this land. But he made a statement when he was letting them, or was getting them ready to go in. And they were told to destroy every man, woman, child, animal, destroy it all. And we say, well, why would God want to destroy little children? Well, I think it's probably not such a big task to figure out what God's going to do with them. They're not sinning. They're innocent. God knows how to handle people who die and are innocent. It's the ones that have lived and have been sinners all their lives and have brought in idolatry of the things that God just does not put up with. Those are the ones he wanted to be destroyed. And said, take them all out. We'll start over with you. But you know, They didn't do that. And what do you think God's going to do with that kind of rebellion on his hand? He says, fine. But if you don't, I'm not going to stand up to fight your battles for you anymore. If you're not going to do what I said, then you can fight your own battles and pay the consequences. Well, they did. Big time for the rest of their lives. And the bottom line is, God wants obedience. Just plain, simple obedience. That's what he wants. That's what he was asking these people for. And that was the very thing that they didn't come through with. In one place, Dan was supposed to take on the Philistines. Dan was afraid of the Philistines. And Dan went away from the place he had been assigned as his inheritance up to a place close to Mount Hermon. And the Philistines were problems to God's people for the rest of their lives. They were coming up all the time. Even in the reign of Saul, and this down after the kingdom, it's had its first king, and the Philistines have charged him and threatened his army and challenged him. And we see David stepping up and taking care of that situation for Saul. But again, Philistines, giants, the people said, we can't take them. God said, you either destroy them all or you can fight your own battles from here on out. And that's what we're going to be running into as we go through the rest of this class. We're going to find that these people didn't do what God wanted them to do. I'm going to show you a couple of cases here where people say this is Mount Sinai here at the bottom. That's the current assessment. A lot of people say that doesn't fit the Bible definition of Mount Sinai. Another one says that they didn't go that way at all. They went down here and went across this arm of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, and over into the land of Midian to a mountain called Mount Albaz. And that is where some claim to be Mount Sinai. Others have it at a place back up in here. There's also some concern about where Kadesh Barnea is. Some people say it's right here. This guy does. And it's the same as Petra. Now later on I'm going to show you some actual pictures from Petra, and you'll see the kind of workmanship that these people are capable of doing. But anyway, I show you this so you can know that they just really don't know where it is. And I didn't see a lot of profit to be made by going through something that even the best scholars that are working on it today can't tell us what route they took or where Mount Sinai is. We've had one that's been used for years, but the only thing they can say about it is probably not the one. So that's about all you're going to hear me get into on that. Because I'm convinced that when they run into some evidence that's irrefutable, then maybe we can come back and revisit that part of the story. But for right now, they got their law from Mount Sinai, wherever it is, they found it. We're having a hard time finding it. And I'm content to leave that part of it at that situation. Any questions or comments? Somebody? What I've said in this slide, it's on the board now. I've said that what do we know about the route of the Exodus? Very little. We know they left Egypt. We know they went to Mount Horeb. We know that they got their law there. And God has kept His promise for the land and also for the nation. Because until He gave those people their law to guide them in their everyday life and their interactions with Him and with each other, they were nothing more than a mob of people. And with that law, now God has fulfilled two parts of His three-part promise. The promise that is to come is for the seed through which all nations of the earth will be blessed. And these people are carrying with them at this time all of the information that they need to know that eventually God is intending for the Gentiles to be brought into His fold too. But how they got out of Egypt, I don't know. Where Mount Horeb is, I don't know. If somebody runs into it somewhere, let me know. I'd like to know it myself. But I'm not going to waste a lot of your time trying to postulate where something is that I know good and well nobody knows. But I know God has kept His promise to those people. And that's about where I'm going to stop for tonight.